ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Ever since a beef Wellington was used for murder, I've been wondering, why does a mushroom have the ability to kill humans? Sure, no one wants to be eaten, but how will the message about your toxicity get out if all the witnesses are dead? And if fungi can do that, then what else can it do? Anne Jones here, investigating mushrooms. Search for What the Duck and look for mushrooms. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National, leading the national conversation of legal stories and cases. Is the law keeping up with the rapid increase in deepfake pornographic images of young people being shared online?
We've received more than double the number of reports about digitally altered intimate images relating to people under 18 in the last 18 months than we did in the 7 years previously. And 4 out of 5 of those reports relate to females.
When it comes to online abuse using AI-generated images, are our criminal and civil laws fit for purpose? That's coming up. First, the federal government says it wants to reform the Freedom of Information system.
The FOI system currently is not working for anyone. FOI is a vital feature of democracy, but right now the system is broken.
This is the biggest attack on freedom of information in 15 years, and it's not an accident.
If modernisation means making it worse for the public and better for a government that wants to hide information, well then, by all means, you could call this modernising.
Last Friday, the Senate Legal and Constitutional Affairs Legislation Committee heard the views of a number of organisations with concerns about the government's FOI Amendment Bill 2025. Gabrielle Appleby is a professor of law at the University of New South Wales, and she's also head of research at the Centre for Public Integrity, one of the organisations that appeared before this committee. Gabrielle, what exactly is the FOI system and why is it important?
FOI, or Freedom of Information, is sometimes referred to as the public's right to know or as a fundamental democratic right. And what it is it provides a system, a process by which the public can access government information, which is really public information, of course. And it's connected to democracy in 3 different ways. First, it has a sort of direct connection in that we have a system of representative and responsible government, where the government is responsible to the parliament and the parliament to the people. And freedom of information, access to information, means that the parliament and the people know what government is doing. And so they can make decisions about them, particularly whether to vote them in or not. But it's also connected to democracy and good government in other ways. There's the famous saying from Louis Brandeis from the US Supreme Court that sunlight is the best disinfectant. And of course, transparency drives good decisions. It means if people are looking in, you're more likely to do the right thing. So FOI is important in driving good government decision-making as well. And then thirdly and finally, freedom of information I think of as a facilitator of other accountability mechanisms. So if you think of mechanisms like royal commissions or anti-corruption commissions or ombudsmen, they need to know what's going on in order to know what to investigate. And freedom of information can very often be the way in which those mechanisms know where to start looking. So it facilitates accountability through other mechanisms as well. So you can see it's very strongly connected to democracy.
So what sorts of information have come to light because of FOI? Can you give me some examples of when you say it has been effective?
Wow, there's just so many examples that you could draw upon. Most recently, there was an FOI application that led to the discovery of a cover-up of a gas leak in relation to gas operations in the Northern Territory. And that wouldn't have come to light, and the public concerns about that wouldn't have come to light without an FOI application. But there's just so many examples across so many different areas. And particularly on last week, we heard from a number of journalists who are great users of the FOI system and all the different ways in which FOI has been used to facilitate really important investigative journalism.
Now, the federal government says the current system is expensive and unworkable. It says it takes too many resources to process requests. Attorney General Michelle Rowland said public servants spent 1 million hours processing FOI requests in 2023-2024. This cost the government $86 million. There are also concerns about what they describe as automated requests, AI-generated requests. They say the system is open to exploitation by foreign governments. And FOI constrains the ability of public servants to provide frank and fearless advice. Do you accept that the system is not working well?
So look, I accept, and I think that almost everyone accepts that the FOI system is not working well. It's in desperate need of modernising. It hasn't had a major overhaul since 2010. But what I don't accept is that the government is framing this bill as a modernisation of FOI, and there are legitimate concerns that the government has raised, but it's very much a one-sided set of concerns. There are also really legitimate concerns from the users of FOI, the public, the people that FOI is supposed to be serving in relation to the costs of FOI applications, particularly if you have to appeal decisions, in relation to delay. Some FOI applications can take 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years to finalise. And there is also concerns that government is abusing the exemptions, that is, claiming them when they're not legitimate, that exist in the FOI Act. So I would agree that there's a need for modernisation, but I disagree that this particular bill addresses the real fundamental concerns with the way the FOI system is operating for democracy.
So, Gabrielle, what are the major changes that the government is proposing in this bill? And which of those changes do you have the most concerns around?
There's one change, which is a change to the Objects Clause of the FOI Act. Now, the Objects Clause of the FOI Act currently focuses on the community's access to information, public participation in government, increased accountability, all of these objects of FOI. The bill would introduce a balance between these objects and what's referred to as effective government. And so we now see a major shift in the focus of the FOI Act. And this will flow on to interpreting the rest of the provisions. And the explanatory memorandum of the government explicitly says that's the intention, that now when decision makers and tribunals and courts come to interpreting the Act, they need to not just think about democratic right to access information, but the need for effective government as well. And that represents a major shift that I'm deeply concerned about.
And briefly, do we know what this idea of effective government might encompass?
I mean, it means that when there's a question about how long an FOI application might take to process or whether an exemption applies, instead of leaning towards transparency and proactive disclosure, what you'll see is that the interpretation will lean towards more secrecy and efficiency in government operations and dealing with requests. And so that's a major concern for users of the system, that there's going to now be a lean away from that proactive disclosure object of the Act.
There's another change, as I understand it, around the cabinet documents and how they are described and what they might encompass. Is that a concern for you?
Yeah, look, that's the second set of changes that's sort of a major part of the bill. There's two parts to that. There's an expansion of the absolute exemption for cabinet documents. And there's a number of parts of that expansion. One of the most concerning is a change from documents previously had to be for the dominant purpose of a cabinet submission, and now they just need to be for a substantive purpose. But there's other ways in which the exemptions is broadened as well. And coupled with that, there is a broadening of the conditional exemption for deliberative process documents. Now, deliberative process documents are documents that are sort of preliminary to government action and decisions. And for the first time, the bill will now include a set of factors that weigh against disclosure and for more secrecy. And these include encouraging frank and fearless advice for public servants, as well as the effective operation of government again. So you see this change to the Objects Clause filtering through to an expansion of exemptions. Now, I hold a number of concerns about those expansions. First being that we know that those exemptions have in the past been abused, that is, claimed when they're not rightfully applicable. I know during the Robodebt Royal Commission, for example, the commissioner was deeply critical of the use of the cabinet exemption. In fact, she proposed the repeal of the cabinet exemption. And the deliberative process exemption is a really problematic exemption as well. And the courts have frequently told the government that things like embarrassment or public confusion are not reasons not to disclose documents. These are really fraught exemptions, and what we see in this bill is an expansion of those exemptions.
What about the idea that the government's put out the idea that there are a lot of AI-generated FOI applications now, and they are totally clogging the system and rendering it unworkable and unusable?
The government has made a number of claims in relation to the reasons why it's made some of the smaller amendments, such as the introduction of an application fee, the removal of anonymous requests, the ability to declare individual requests frivolous, vexatious, and also the protection of the information of the FOI decision maker. And it said, look, really driving these changes has been concerns about AI-generated requests, foreign powers-generated requests, potentially requests from criminal gangs, and the threat to public servants. Now, the extent to which there has been evidence provided, particularly in relation to the AI generation and the foreign interference, is very much wanting. The government has, for example, when asked in the Senate to produce the documents on which these amendments had been made that provide the evidence for this, they provided two non-academic articles from America, not from Australia, and a heavily redacted memo in relation to the Australian situation, which shows no evidence of this actually occurring. The Attorney General's Department, when they appeared before the Senate committee last week, clarified that what in fact the concern was the propensity for the system to be abused in this way, not that it is actually at the moment being inundated by these types of requests, or that these types of requests, for example, from foreign actors or criminal gangs have actually been identified in the system.
The Attorney General did tell the AM program a few weeks ago that there were some 600 requests made at once to the Office of the eSafety Commissioner. So I guess the automated requests there are concerns about workloads and resources for small agencies like the Office of the eSafety Commissioner.
Yeah, the eSafety Commissioner, the example that was being referred to by the Attorney General and others, did come from a website which allows members of the public to request information that's being held in relation to their social media. Those requests were all generated from that one website, but they weren't AI generated. They were actual requests that were generated. The documents that have been released show that there was concern from the eSafety Commissioner that there might have been a problem for the IT, but the IT indicated that no, actually, the government's IT systems can definitely cope with these issues. Look, I think volumes of requests, the way that technology changes how requests are being made, these are all reasons why the FOI system does need review. But we should need to think about this not just from the departments, the agencies and the government perspective, but also from the user's perspective. And so that these types of things like websites that facilitate requests, they are now a legitimate part of the landscape. How do we make sure that they operate within the system in a sustainable way that means that FOI can work for the people and for democracy?
So what does the Centre for Public Integrity want from the FOI system? And acknowledging that there are real problems with the current system, how do you want to fix them? What do you want?
As a first call, the Centre for Public Integrity, along with almost all of the civil society organisations and submissions to the Senate inquiries, want this bill to be withdrawn and that the suite of amendments contained in it to be rethought, and that a full and comprehensive review is undertaken. Now, the need for a full and comprehensive review of the FOI system is not a new idea. Back in 2013, a government statutory review of the FOI system said that was exactly what was needed. The government members themselves in the 2023 Senate inquiry into the FOI system said, we really need to consider a full and comprehensive review of the FOI system. And so the Centre for Public Integrity is saying, yeah, let's have that review. Let's think about how technology and AI has changed how government does business, how the fact that documents are no longer in paper form, and how technology and AI can support openness, transparency and access, not just how to close off government openness because of the concerns about AI and technology. So we want to see a full review that means that we have an FOI system that is fit for the modern age and that will stand the tests of the next few years. There hasn't been a review of the FOI system since 2010. It's time to have that review. But let's not just hear about government concerns. Let's hear about those user concerns as well.
At this point, the bill can't pass through the Senate. The Coalition, the Greens and the Independents all say that they won't pass the bill in the Senate. So where's the process at now with this bill?
So the bill is currently before the Senate Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee. It heard evidence last Friday and it will report in early December. Now, as you say, the numbers are such in the Senate that currently it will not pass. And so the government has choices ahead of it, whether it puts the bill to a vote or whether it decides to withdraw the bill. It has indicated that it intends to continue to push forward with the bill, but it really seems like the numbers are on the wall for the need to rethink this particular review of FOI.
Gabrielle, in conclusion, this current moment in terms of FOI, can you put it in its broader history and context?
The Australian FOI system, introduced back in 1982, was really, it was pioneering. It was part of a suite of what was called the New Administrative Law Reforms, where Australia really opened up a lot of its government decision-making, opened it up for review, accountability and transparency. It was then subject to another really pioneering set of reforms under Senator John Faulkner in 2009-2010. We had the creation of the Australian Information Commissioner, which was supposed to be a champion of FOI, the pro-disclosure, pro-access objects of the Act. And so we've had a sort of a history of being really on the cutting edge of trying to make FOI work for democracy. Now, over time, whether it be because of government's attacks of the system, underfunding the Information Commissioner, for example, or just, you know, changes in how the world works and changes in technology, that system has now fallen behind. And research like that of the Centre for Public Integrity has really shown serious delays and abuse of the system. So we're now in need of reform again, and we are arguing that that needs to again be cutting-edge reform for the FOI, not a regressive reform like we see here.
And you think it is doable, it is practical, it is economical to do this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that a thorough structural and systemic review of the FOI Act will reveal ways in which transparency and openness can be achieved in a modern democracy with technology and AI and in a way that works for the Australian people.
UNSW Law Professor Gabrielle Appleby, Research Director with the Centre for Public Integrity, one of the organisations that appeared before the committee to express its concerns about the bill. Thank you for speaking to The Law Report.
Pleasure as always. Thanks, Damien.
You're listening to The Law Report on Radio National, available as a podcast via the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. When it comes to online abuse involving deepfake images, are our criminal and civil laws fit for purpose? Are they up to the task of responding to fast-changing technology? New South Wales Police are currently investigating reports involving the creation and distribution of deepfake pornographic images of girls at a Sydney school. And in a legal first, a Queensland man was recently fined $350,000 for creating and posting deepfake naked images. Richard Fleming is the General Counsel with the Office of the eSafety Commissioner. Richard, what do we know about the police investigation involving a school in Sydney?
So, Damien, we've read in the press that there's been an alleged deepfake intimate image investigation in relation to a Sydney school. We're seeing one of these reports about once a week, and it is quite disturbing for everyone involved. We've received more than double the number of reports about digitally altered intimate images relating to people under 18 in the last 18 months than we did in the 7 years previously. And 4 out of 5 of those reports relate to females.
So the Office of the eSafety Commissioner receiving these kinds of reports on a weekly basis.
And that just shows how easy it is to access these services, mainly online.
Services which generate these kinds of images.
Absolutely. So the barrier to entry for these services is quite low, and they're often available to anyone who searches for them on the web.
Is the Office of the eSafety Commissioner involved in the reported deepfake investigation at a Sydney school?
Without talking about the specifics in this matter, we have been concerned enough to prepare a toolkit for schools to use in these kinds of incidents. So the toolkit's to support educators, and it really takes a victim survivor-centred approach in responding to online safety incidents, including dealing with deep fake incidents. We see that educators play a really important role in that initial response. They know the children involved. They can support the affected staff and students. They can also contact local police and eSafety.
Okay, contacting local police. Okay, that shows us that there are criminal law dimensions to this. What are the criminal laws around deep fakes across Australia?
So they're usually state-based laws. So in New South Wales, there's now laws, as in Victoria and South Australia, and these criminalise the creation and distribution of deepfake intimate images.
And what about at the federal level?
So there's been some action over the last couple of years in relation to deepfake images. Last year, the government announced some reforms, and this year, in response to the Online Safety Act review, the government is looking to introduce laws relating to nudify apps and undetectable stalking apps.
So as I understand it, federal laws generally focus on the sharing of images online, and state and territory laws focus on the creation of those images, but are now being expanded to also encompass the distribution of these images. And New South Wales, I think, has just introduced legislation to expand existing offences to include the distribution of deepfake images without consent. Coming back to reports involving a Sydney school, what happens when a perpetrator is a child? Are children prosecuted, or can they be prosecuted?
I think that does depend on the laws involved, but I think the answer is possibly. So usually the local police will conduct interviews, seize devices, and where that's necessary, and they'll also make decisions about the investigation and any subsequent prosecutions. Importantly for the victim survivors, eSafety has powers to help remove intimate images and video that was shared without their consent. We have a very high success rate removing that harmful material that's reported to us, and that's up to about 98% of cases in image-based abuse.
And are you involved in that process with the reports out of that Sydney school?
I prefer not to say in relation to that school, but generally we do get reports to us on a quite frequent basis, as we say, about one per week.
Now, because we have a patchwork of laws, federal and state and territory laws around the country, there does appear on some occasions to be cases where perpetrators fall between the cracks. There was, I think, a case involving a Canberra public servant. Can you tell me what you know about that?
Yeah, so I think this is a case of the legislation catching up with the technology. So in relation to that matter, my understanding is that it fell between the Commonwealth offences that relate to the use or misuse of a carriage service to share images, so the telecommunications network, and the local laws in the ACT, which my understanding at this stage doesn't have an offence that relates to deepfake intimate images. So unless it's shared across the telecommunications network, it's not covered by the Commonwealth offences.
As I understand it, this Canberra public servant created something like 100 deepfake images of something like 16 of his co-workers, but because it couldn't be proven that he distributed the images or sent them anywhere, he created the images, but he didn't publish them or distribute them. Therefore, he fell between the cracks.
That's my understanding from the reports, Damien.
So is it possible, while we're talking to the around the criminal law, is it also possible to prosecute the platforms or the websites that assist or promote in the creation of image-based abuse?
So there's two angles to that. So firstly, the Online Safety Act has a range of codes and standards that apply up and down the tech stack. So where there is an app, we have a code that applies to apps, and that could potentially lead to prosecution. It could also lead to action against an app store that doesn't comply with their obligations under the code to keep this material off their app stores. In relation to the services themselves, this is less clear. As I mentioned, these are websites that are often based offshore and can move domains quite easily. And so that sort of gets us back to the government's recent announcement around Nudify apps and undetectable stalking apps and legislative amendments relating to that.
And what are those announcements?
So the government's looking to introduce amendments to the criminal code to criminalise the use of those apps to prevent harm to Australians.
So far we've been talking about the criminal law. We've also just seen the first civil case of its kind brought by the Office of the eSafety Commissioner. Richard, who is Queensland man Antonio Rotondo and what images did he create?
So Mr. Rotondo, as you say, is an Australian who created deepfake intimate images of famous Australians. He did so in about 2023, uploaded those images to a website called MrDeepfakes.com, which has since been shut down. We took steps to have the intimate images removed, which is our usual first step. He resisted, and there was a number of cases through the courts, including contempt proceedings against Mr. Rotondo. He then ultimately agreed to remove the images, agreed that he engaged in the conduct by posting the images, and then the court has recently imposed a civil pecuniary penalty of over $350,000 against him for that conduct.
And this is the first civil case of its kind in Australia?
It is. And we took the case because it sends a really important message to those involved in creating deepfake intimate images that there are consequences if you do that.
Are there other similar civil actions being taken by the Office of the eSafety Commissioner?
We don't have any in the courts at the moment. It's just another tool in our toolkit. And depending on the right case, we won't hesitate to take the same action.
Could you take action against some of those online platforms which help create these images?
That is possible. It does depend on the nature of the service and the individual circumstances in each case. We have put out a media release that talks about steps we've taken, enforcement steps we've taken in relation to a UK-based Nudify service. It's a service that receives over 100,000 hits from Australian visitors per month, so it's an important thing for us to focus on. Don't really have much more to say on that other than it is an area of focus for us because it is an area of significant online harm for Australians.
Mm. Coming back to Antonio Rotondo, so you took action against him under, I think, Section 75 of the Online Safety Act, which prohibits the posting of intimate images without consent. Look, when he was sent that removal notice, I understand that he responded by saying, quote, "This means nothing to me. I'm not in Australia." I think he returned to Australia on holiday and he was arrested on matters not related to this proceeding. But when questioned about these deepfake images, he didn't express any remorse. He described them as fun, like having X-ray vision glasses. That kind of mindset is very, very disturbing. How common is that mindset amongst both adults and children?
I think it is common and really does underlie a lot of the reasoning, I think, that goes through people's heads when they decide to create these images. They certainly don't think about the devastating impacts that these kind of incidents have on the individuals involved. It's really traumatizing for them and can lead to long-lasting effects.
And are our laws fit for purpose to address this terrible crime?
We do have good laws and good tools in our toolkit. The challenge we often have is applying those laws given that's individuals involved, there's overseas-based platforms, just those practical enforcement challenges. And so anything we can do, including, as we previously talked about, the state-based laws about the creation of deepfake intimate images, anything we can do there to push back on this scourge is really, really welcome.
Richard Fleming, General Counsel with the Office of the eSafety Commissioner, thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
Thanks, Damien.
That's the Law Report for this week. Do follow the program on the ABC Listen app. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. To follow, all you need to do is click on the heart button. A big thanks to producer Christina Cucoglia and also to audio producer Riley Mellis. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more Law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.